So many of you listening to this would have had a plummet in your KiwiSaver. There are some providers that have done well over the long run. There's definitely been a recorrection that's having a big impact on people. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to go back all the way to 2020 in March, when we first came across COVID and the same thing or something similar happened with your KiwiSaver. And this was when we didn't really know what was happening, but we understood the fundamentals of KiwiSaver. And provided that you're diversified, you've got the right managers, it's all about just sticking through. So I just thought I'd share a trip down memory lane in honor of COVID never ending and also me being confined and surrounded by people with COVID. But apparently I don't have it yet. So I'll kick into it and I'd love to hear what you guys think. And unfortunately, we say the same thing over and over. And fortunately, we say the same thing over and over because it is sound, sane, sensible financial advice.
Welcome back, everyone. We've got quite an interesting installment. We brought our coronavirus expert. Not that he's actually an expert. No one's really.
What can you say that's good about it? There's nothing good about coronavirus.
No, there's definitely not.
The big issue, I think, there's two issues, isn't there? One, the health effects, which are traumatic on those people that are affected, you know, because it could be fatal. And they talk that for 100 people that get the virus, which is a flu-like virus, I understand, the mortality rate is anywhere between 2-4%. And that doesn't maybe sound like much, but if you extrapolate that out, that's an awful lot of people. It also tends to be fatal for people in different age groups and more elderly and possibly young rather than sort of fitter, middle-aged sort of people. So again, it has a huge effect potentially on a sector of society. And of course there's the other issue about, do the public health officials and the hospitals have the ability to cope with a mass infection? So there's lots of balls up in the air. But the one that people are seeing immediately, of course, is the financial impact of this event. And I'm aware of school trips being cancelled because the children are going to countries like Japan or Europe, or plan to go to Japan and Europe, and a decision has been made that to cancel those trips. And is there adequate insurance in place to protect the parents and the students who will have already paid for the trip? So potentially huge financial impact on those people. And then, of course, the financial impact on various businesses. We've heard some horrific numbers in respect to potential losses for airlines. Then, of course, there's exporters, the logging industry, the tourism industry, and the people in education. If you were running a language school and most of your students were coming from the East, particularly from China, this will be something that your business may not be able to recover from.
Fair. I mean, it has a huge flow-on effect. And I guess why I brought it up was effectively just to demonstrate crowd hysteria and how that flows through. And my mum, she self-quarantined herself because effectively someone from her work was on the same plane as a person that had the coronavirus. So she contained herself because she shares a residence with our great auntie, and she's close to her 90s. So it does. Yeah, if you have a weakened immune system, it can have a huge effect.
And I'm not sure that people are aware, because I'm not really aware, of how we know it's contagious or infectious, but is it by breathing the same air, or is it by some sort of physical contact? There needs to be a little bit more information. Otherwise, you do get that mass hysteria. And we saw in Auckland how suddenly when the information came out, the supermarkets got emptied of certain products. And I saw on the news, they said that the amount of people who panicked were only 9% out of 100. So 91% didn't. But that 9%, that had a huge effect. It just emptied the shelves of the supermarket. You imagine if you had the same issue in respect of the banking sector and people felt that the banks were going to fall over, so they better get their money quick. And 9% of people rushed to the banks. There'd be a lot of people standing outside banks very unhappy. And that becomes a little bit of the start of a tsunami. And the financial impacts are quite severe, let alone the emotional impacts of people being fearful something's going to happen. And it's a bit like Chicken Little thinking the sky's going to fall in. It's not going to fall in. It's not going to fall in respect to the coronavirus. I mean, there will quickly become some sort of treatment or protocol around it so that people are a lot more aware and a little bit more careful. The public health authorities are doing an amazing job of not only isolating people who have been diagnosed with the infection, but also tracking back to see who they've had contact with. So there's quite a lot of information and stuff happening there. And from that point of view, it's pretty impressive. And you'd have to be impressed with how the Chinese authorities have dealt with it, because they basically just shut down parts of the country, and in some respects the whole country, and people have been incredibly compliant and doing what they've been asked to do. I don't know if that would necessarily happen in New Zealand or
no.
in North America or Europe, but certainly in China that's happened. And that will, I believe, get to a stage where they've got this particular virus under control. And remember, there are lots of viruses. The flu virus is hardly under control. In New Zealand, 500 to 600 people die each year from the flu virus. Well, but we know that if you've got the flu, this is what you need to do. You go and see the doctor. There is some level of treatment. But people who have a low immune system or elderly, they can succumb to it, just the same as pneumonia.
For sure. And that's the thing. I mean, people get caught up. There's even something called the bystander bias, where like people won't come to aid someone that's in trouble because they look to others as a sign on how they should behave. For example, if the fire alarm goes off, you look around, no one reacts, then you don't react. So it's the same thing in terms of hysteria. People, when they see this craziness of buying all this water or seeing the news, and they start freaking out and they start jumping on that bandwagon. And a common thing in our industry is you probably hear people trying to do market timing. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about that, about some people maybe talking about changing their assets from growth to more of a conservative, and why that's a big mistake.
Well, I did get a phone call in respect of someone thinking about moving their KiwiSaver from a growth arrangement to a more conservative arrangement. And this particular person was still in paid employment. They wouldn't be looking to retire, possibly for another 10 to 15 years. And it would have been a huge mistake. There's going to be, and there's volatility in the investment markets because people can act irrationally. It's the fear arrangement, the fear that something terrible is going to happen, so I better get in quick and cut my losses. Well, actually, all you're doing is incurring a loss, because you've not made a loss until you sell something, and you shouldn't sell it unless there's a very good reason to sell it. And fear of the unknown is not a good reason. What happens to people when they, if you like, go from a growth to an income or conservative type portfolio for the wrong reasons? They, if they do that at the bottom of a market, they've crystallized the loss, and they really reduce the opportunity to recover from that, because they won't move back into the growth portfolio until, of course, maybe at the wrong time. Sell at the bottom, buy at the top. Not a good recipe for making money. When you've got KiwiSaver, it's more like fire and forget. Clearly, you need to be in a risk profile that's suitable for your time of life. So if you're getting close to retirement, you might be in a balanced or conservative fund, because you have a feeling you're going to crystallize the arrangement, redeem the investment within a short period of time, and you wouldn't like to see it drop by 10, 15 or 20%. But if you're saving towards retirement, you're going to be in KiwiSaver for the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years. why would you be concerned about ups and downs in the market as long as you know that you've got quality investments in your portfolio? And quality investments are about companies that have good business models, that have a future, that've got good management, and those companies will continue to do well. You think of companies that produce products that we buy and use every day. Now, unless you know that that company is a Kodak that suddenly might not have a future because suddenly people no longer buy film as such and everything's digital, and of course Kodak didn't see that coming.
No.
They didn't see the black swan event of the digital transformation. And that, for those investors, would have been a total loss. That's another reason why you don't have all your eggs in one basket. But if you're doing it yourself, you have a huge responsibility. But if you're going through a managed fund, which is what KiwiSaver is effectively, and certainly the approach that we use for our clients who are saving or spending in retirement, saving for retirement or spending in retirement, a managed fund means that effectively you've got people who are experts, who are qualified, competent, making day-to-day decisions of what type of financial security they should buy in a particular situation. So if it's a share market fund or an equity fund manager, they will be looking at the companies that make up the portfolio to see, is this a buy, hold, or sell? And in this market, there's an opportunity to buy when prices fall irrationally because of the market hysteria. People kind of like lemmings rushing to the cliff and jumping off. And what we want our clients to do and what we think our listeners should do is be counter-cyclical. If people are rushing to the cliff, you should be heading the other way. But if you're buying assets, look at the quality of the assets you're buying. And if they're underpriced, isn't that a great opportunity to buy? With KiwiSaver, you have the ability to use is often referred to as dollar cost averaging. Think of your favorite tin of salmon at the supermarket, normally priced at a dollar. If suddenly, because of one reason or other, they've overstocked or people, for whatever, are worried about the salmon, it drops to 50 cents and you are comfortable and convinced there's nothing wrong with the quality of the product, wouldn't you buy more, not less?
Yeah.
And if you're spending $100 on salmon a week, which might buy you 100 cans, that $100 this week will buy you 200 cans.
Mm.
And when the price gets back to normal, you've bought at 50 and now they're worth at a dollar. So that's just being sensible in respect of how you invest, taking into account that you have a longer time horizon. You buy quality, you ensure that you get advice as to do you buy, hold, or sell, and we can do that using money financial managers, fund managers, if you like, as opposed to trying to do it on an individual basis. But it's very hard to do that on an individual basis because it's sometimes hard to see the wood for the trees. You're too close,
yeah,
and you're worried about things, whereas someone who's independent of the transaction, standing back, will assess, is this company doing well, not doing well, could do better? So that becomes that buy, hold, or sell.
Yeah, I think decision. I think it's really important that you had that degree of separation, because when you're in the pit and you're obviously, you can potentially get biases of feeling as though you're right because you've had a couple wins in a row. And then also you're emotionally invested in it. So when things go down, that's direct impact on your income. So you're likely to take greater risk. There's also, and in terms of a dollar cost averaging implementation sort of thing, you could potentially just save into the fund every month. That would be a way to implement the dollar cost averaging. But there's actually quite an interesting debate at the moment going between, I think it was initiated by the Financial Markets Authority, and it was talking about active versus passive. So I'm wondering if you could talk about the pros and cons of either.
Well, passive investment is basically like following an index, following the market. A good example of that would be a fund manager like Vanguard, which is used by one of the local KiwiSaver providers in New Zealand. And Vanguard basically is an index fund that buys the US share market. So if the US share market goes down by 10%, the fund will go down by 10%. If it goes up by 10%, the fund will go up. And that's the sort of investment strategy that Blind Freddy could do, because you're just following an index and it's all computer generated, which probably is a little bit of another worry, because you know, at the end of the day, what physically stands behind that? You know, are they physically holding a portfolio or not? I suspect not. It's really just an index. The active managers are managers that wouldn't hold a physical portfolio, and they would be making decisions on a day-by-day basis as to whether they should buy, hold, or sell. They also probably have the ability to use futures arrangements, a put option, to protect the value of the portfolio if the market should sell, without having to physically sell the portfolio. Often we hear, and certainly if you think of last year and the year before, many of the commentators, and it would sometimes go back to really informed people like the Consumer Magazine, I say that tongue in cheek, who say the only thing you should do is buy a fund that is passive. Why? Because it's cheap. You know, so everything should be made in respect of a financial decision on the basis of a cost. The cheaper it is, the better it is. Well, that's clearly nonsense, because if we felt that that was the case, we look at the car that you're driving around. Have you bought the cheapest car, or have you bought the car that you feel comfortable in? Is it, you know, there's arrangements in respect of reliability, safety, comfort, a whole lot of things. We don't just buy the cheapest vehicle that's out. Otherwise, in the old days, we'd all be driving Russian Ladas. So if you look at that from the financial markets point of view, cheap is not always best. Sometimes it's good to have a passive fund, an index fund, because it's sometimes in markets, when the markets are going up, for an active manager, it's difficult for them to beat the index. But when a market starts going down, the active manager doesn't have to leap off the cliff with the rest of the lemmings. They can exit a company they're not thinking, or they're thinking it's not going to be doing particularly well. So in this sort of market, you know, they might have reduced their exposure to airline stocks. They might have reduced their exposure to companies that are going to be adversely affected by this coronavirus concern going longer than expected. Because that's the issue, isn't it? I mean, if you think about China, if China gets closed for longer, that's going to have a huge impact on the supply chain, because China is the manufacturer of the world. And there needed to be probably a little bit of risk management around that to say, well, there's a good lesson here going forward. If we've got all our manufacturing done in China because it's cheaper, and that's pretty much why people have gone there, and we know in New Zealand a lot of the manufacturing that was happening here in the past has been, shall we say, shipped offshore. The risk management issue is, if suddenly if things turn pear-shaped, as they appear to be doing, you can't turn that manufacturing on immediately. It's going to take some time. And what happens in the interim? So there'll be winners and losers in this sort of scenario. What an active manager can do, though, is look at that and make decisions on that buy, hold, and sell arrangement. They can use futures arrangements to protect the physical portfolio. A passive manager can't. So, you know, what's my view on this? I think you need a bit of both. I've never been one of the people who say, let's put it all into passive because it's really cheap as chips, and off we go. I've never taken the view that it should all be an active management, because the active manager will always outperform the market, because that's not true. It's about a balance between the two.
Sure. And I mean, yeah, they both had their merits, and there's also obviously concerns as well from the perspective from a passive side of things. My concern is that you've got a number of people seeing index funds as the flavor of the month. And what they're doing...
Well, they were. They're probably not at the moment.
Yeah, they're probably freaking out a little bit. But like you think about if you've got a person that's directly invested in a passively managed index fund, shares, and they don't have the emotional support. So suddenly you have a situation like the coronavirus and they're not quite sure why they invested, what the underlying reasons are for doing so. And now there's not as many barriers for them to make a buy and sell decision. So suddenly you've got all these people that don't have quite the emotional fortitude or understanding yet to know when to hold and when to sell. And they effectively can do it very quickly. So you've got all these investments and then suddenly there's an economic downturn, which the economy cycles like seasons. You have winter and you have summer. So what's going to happen then? It could fall like dominoes. You know, everyone could freak out and start selling and realize, crystallize that loss.
Well, that's a contagion effect, isn't it? But, you know, people sell and because there's more sellers than buyers, the price drops. Wonderful opportunity for the counter-cyclical investor because prices are falling and they're buying into that as long as they're comfortable and believe the prices will recover. The issue often, and this is a good advertisement for people like Ryan and myself, is that those people who have got an advisor that they are comfortable with, if you like, their trusted advisor, they're not likely to make irrational decisions that will cost them money, because someone will sit down and talk to them about, let's have a look at the, you know, what's really happening here. Are these companies we've invested in worth less than what they were in the past? Because there's a drop in price, is that more about supply and demand? Has there been a change to their business model? Is there going to be a short-term or a longer-term effect on profitability? And every company is a little bit different. Every organisation's a little bit different. If you've got an advisor there, you'll make a rational, informed decision. If there is no advisor there, all you're hearing is the voice in your head, you're reading the papers, listening to the news, and you're going to get a very one-sided view of the world. The media are not necessarily known to give balanced advice. You know, it's an old saying, isn't it? You know, it's bad news that sells. It's not good news. The headlines are always about the extreme, and then you read the article and actually it's not that extreme. But what's the other? I think the other thing, if it bleeds, it leads. Is that the famous newspaper saying? If it bleeds, it leads. And I know that there's a lot of people out there who have made investment decisions not on the basis of the advice of an advisor, but they've made it on the basis of the advice of friends or on the basis of something they've read, a newspaper columnist, and they think those people are gurus. They're not gurus at all. They're just basically selling a story, and they're not going to be accountable. So I remember years ago, a columnist used to suggest to people that all they should do is put all their money into a world share market index, because it was cheap and it followed the world share market index, and everyone could see over time that global shares outperformed every other type of investment, and it was wonderful. And then 2008, 2009 came along and it was less than wonderful. Yeah. Those people would have panicked, sold, crystallized a loss, and not that it was a good decision in the first place, but if they'd actually got a bit of advice and you know, hunkered down and soldiered through, they'd have come out the other side and then hopefully rebalanced so they had an investment strategy that wasn't all about one type of investment sector, but was actually balanced across cash, bonds, property and equities, reflecting their risk tolerance. And everyone's different because we're all in different times of our life and have different needs and different resources, they'd have a much happier outcome. Well, we had a client event the other day and had an economist come and talk to our clients, and there was no panic. Our clients don't worry unnecessarily. If they are worried, they know they can pick up the phone and talk to us, and we can address their specific issues. But it was quite interesting listening to this presentation and listening to the questions that came from our clients, and there was no panic. You know, people know that they're either saving for retirement or spending in retirement. They'll have investment strategies that reflect that, and their time horizons are long, not short. So their concern is, how much does my lifestyle cost? Have I got enough money to fund it for the amount of time that I'm going to be no longer in paid employment?
For sure. And that's the thing. Once you've got a diversified portfolio and it's structured the right way, the most important thing is more your lifestyle, life circumstances, when you need the money, risk tolerance, all those good things. And speaking of those things, we've had someone write in or email in. We didn't get it sent by pigeon mail. And they're just asking a few questions. And I've been trying to stump you since 2018. So keep writing in the questions at ryan@oneplan.co.nz. So oneplan.co.nz. And just write in, and then we'll have these questions answered for you. So we won't say the name of this individual, but their question, Greg, a bit long, listeners, so stay involved. But I guess this is the best way to get the most value from us. So I have been looking to sort out my finances and stumbled upon your podcast recently. I've been really enjoying the chats between Greg and yourself. If you're looking for a person to do a sample on, I'd be grateful to have a case done on me. I fear there could be other people in similar situations like me, in or outside of Auckland. I know of other couple of guys I put onto your podcast have got their own questions too in a similar situation. I read that funny, but keep going. This is my current situation. I live on the west coast of the South Island, where I am an engineer working for a dairy manufacturing company. I have one dependent under two and live with my partner, who is a stay-at-home mother. I am continuing to study every year and aim to go further in my career. We own our own house valued at $300,000 and have a $240,000 mortgage on a low interest rate after just completing $80,000 worth of renovations on the house. We used our KiwiSaver 4 years ago to help us buy this first house. We have a vehicle loan of $26,000 at 5.6% interest, which I pay back within an extra $100 a week to speed the repayment up. I earn $120,000 a year on wages. My partner has $26,000 in her KiwiSaver as she is not working currently and is not contributing to the fund, so missing out on the government entitlements. I have $56,000 in my KiwiSaver and put in regular 3% with my employer. $40,000 of this is trapped in there till I'm 65, as it was from previous work in Australia. Also, through my work, we have a ASB super scheme that for the 3% I contribute, my employer will match it 1.5%. In less than 4 years, this was matured to around $40,000. Hope you're still with me. Prior to listening to your podcast, I also joined Super Life and started saving towards some ETF investments. So that's exchange traded funds for people that aren't sure. I was wondering, with the previous information, if we should be doing the following: looking to add some contributions to my partner's KiwiSaver to keep the government money coming through, continue with my ETF investment, or concentrate on adding to my already large super scheme with work, or try lower my existing debt of the car, then home loan, and just leave my current 6% contributions across the super schemes till they are clear. I hope that's either enough or hopefully not too much information, and please paraphrase at any way you like. Maybe I should have done that at the start. Regardless, if you choose to use this example for a podcast, he goes on to ask us about potential help. So,
okay.
Did you remember all that?
I do remember most of it.
I already forgot it. Sorry.
Thank you very much. I don't know. Perhaps I can call this person Peter.
Peter. All right, Peter.
Peter's a good name, Peter. Peter, look, what you've done, in my view, is fantastic. I don't know how old you are, but I suspect, looking at this with one dependent under two, that maybe you're in your mid-30s, could be late 30s.
Yeah.
But probably could be a bit early. It could be in your late 20s. But you certainly, in my view, make some very, very good decisions. I don't have the ability, because this is just an email that's been sent, to talk to you individually, you and your partner, because that's what I'd want to do from the point of view, having an understanding of what your vision of the future is. That is, like, where do you want to live longer term? What do you want to do when you cease paid employment? I don't have an understanding of what is important about money to you, that's your values, nor some of your specific goals. At what stage do you want to cease paid employment, and how much do you want to live on when you get there? You know, and there may be other short-term, medium-term goals. I don't necessarily have all that. So I can only look at what you've sent in, and you have actually asked some specific questions in respect of KiwiSaver and reduction of debt. I suppose, looking at this, my first impression is that what's the most important financial asset to you? Clearly, the most important things to you are your family, your partner, your child, and your health. But from the financial situation, what's the most important financial asset you have? And you may say to me, it's the house that we've bought. And I would differ and say, actually, it's your ability to earn an income. So what I'm impressed about is not only the salary that you're on, but that you're actually reinvesting in yourself to improve that salary.
Mm.
I think it's wonderful that your partner is a stay-at-home mother, because, you know, that doesn't happen very often these days, and there's a lot of pressure on families to have two incomes to live the life. And I can understand that, but sometimes it might be a little short-sighted, because there are bigger considerations in respect of, you know, kids being supported at home and mum or dad being there to do that. So my advice is not for your wife to go out and get a job, or your partner to go and get a job. I think what you do is do what you're doing, is reinvesting. Your partner will go back to work at some stage, I'm sure. In the interim, what should we be doing? Well, let's talk about the question you asked about the government, your partner's KiwiSaver. Clearly, your partner's not working, so she's not going to get a contribution from her employer. However, I think she should contribute at least the minimum, $1,042, so that you get the $521, the tax credit the government gives. That's a 50% return on your money. That's the minimum. If you can put in more, fine, but there's no real need to do it, because that maximises that benefit. And when your partner goes back into employment, so you should immediately re-engage with KiwiSaver, putting in the 3% to get the employer's 3%, or match whatever the employer. So that kind of handles that. In respect of your own saving, what I really like is that you've got a lot of money going into savings, and you're still able to maintain your lifestyle and reduce debt. So I'd continue both your KiwiSaver and your ASB Super Scheme, because, again, you can pick up the tax credit from your KiwiSaver, and you're certainly picking up the contribution from your employer. Now, you've said there that you contribute 3%, the employer will match it with 1.5%. Does your employer match your KiwiSaver contribution? I'd imagine they possibly might. Otherwise, you're not doing as well as you could otherwise, because your employer would normally have to match the 3% with your 3%, with them contributing 3%.
Yeah, they're matching
well.
It. So it's 4.5.
So just you need to make sure that that's kind of working for you. But certainly, KiwiSaver and the ASB Super Scheme means that you're putting something aside for the future. And it also means that with the lesser amount that you've got in your hand, you are maintaining a lifestyle that will be more affordable in the future. See, if people spend 100% of what they earn, they're toast, really, because at the moment they stop paid employment, where will that money come from to replace the income that they lose? Remember, your employment income is temporary. One of the purposes of financial planning and retirement planning is to replace that temporary income with permanent income, where your money is working for you when you cease paid employment. And of course, what we try and do is match up the numbers to make sure that you're able to maintain the lifestyle that you want with the resource that you've got. And there may be a plan A and a plan B and a plan C, because it depends on how those resources are configured. What interests me here, though, is that you're looking at using a fund manager to start saving and above using these exchange traded funds, these ETFs. And I don't think I'd recommend that to you. My view would be any surplus that you've got over and above your contributions to the superannuation retirement type arrangements, you should use that money to repay debt. Now, there's a caveat on that a little bit, because I reckon that you're working hard and your partner's there with the young child, you probably deserve a holiday from time to time. Mm. So I'd direct a little bit of money each month into a holiday fund, so that you've got something to look forward to. I'm not talking about a trip to Europe, you know, but it could be a trip to the islands, it could be a trip to Australia, something that you, or a trip somewhere around New Zealand. You're on the west coast of the South Island, come and see us in Auckland.
It'll be cheap
The city of sales. Yeah. No need to bring a car, because you can't travel in Auckland at the moment with all the cones littering the streets and one-way streets going this week and going the other way next week. But I shouldn't go on. But what I would be doing is redirecting the surplus money that you've got into reduction of debt. Yeah, you've got the car loan in place. Clearly, 5.6% interest is actually pretty good, I would have thought, for a vehicle loan.
Yeah.
And you're paying that promptly. I just keep that momentum going. Yes, you're on a low interest rate with your mortgage, but it's still something that is not tax deductible. So if it's 4%, it's costing you 4% after tax. And you're not going to get 4% after tax in a conservative investment arrangement, in my view, taking no risk. So the surplus money that you have, in my view, should be trying to build up the equity in your home. Now, I don't see that interest rates are going to increase significantly in the near to medium term. But I've lived in a situation where I've never been able to borrow at the interest rates that you're borrowing at the moment. Like many of my generation, it was 11 to 13% if you could get them a loan. That was the interest rate. That went up to 20, 21%. And we thought that anything hovering around 10 was pretty good.
Yeah, crazy.
But now, but our parents, they used to talk about the state advances, interest rates of 3%. And, I thought it was like... that was, maybe that was just fiction. Surely it didn't happen, because we saw nothing like that. And here we are back again with 3 to 4% mortgage rates. So it makes it very attractive to borrow, but people are having to borrow a lot of money. And, they need to think about what would happen if interest rates went back up to 10% again. There'd be a horrific amount of pain. And I've been there. My interest rate went from 11 to 21. What did we do? We just had to suck it up and soldier on. The only good thing was that the quantum of the debt wasn't enormous, because it wasn't in those days, but then our incomes weren't enormous either. So incomes are better, interest rates are lower, but the amount you have to borrow is eye-watering, in my view. Not so much in the West Coast.
No.
It sounds like you've got a great deal.
Yeah, 300K.
You couldn't buy a home in Auckland for $300,000. A friend was telling me that they were advising one of their clients, this chap's a valuer. This young person wanted to buy their first home in a less than salubrious suburb of Auckland. It was a two-bedroom unit with a current valuation of $650,000, needed work on it. Now, until recently, certainly last year, these sort of properties would have sold probably at CV or below, CV being current value. What's happened now, there's been a spike in the Auckland property market.
Mm.
I don't know why. It doesn't make sense at all with all the restrictions in respect of the international buyers and the speculators with the bright line test and the banks mean requiring a significant deposit for people to buy. But he was telling me this property that had a current valuation of $650,000 sold, wait for it, for $885,000.
Jeez.
That's just ridiculous in my view. You know, if that market keeps going that way, at some stage it's got to be like a balloon that if someone pricks it, it'll just deflate. And that's the worry. If someone's had to borrow a truckload of money to get into that property, valuations fall, interest rates go up, you could be steering a situation that happened in the UK, happened to my sister when she and her then husband were over there, that the property they owned was worth less than the debt. And you can get through that if the bank continues to support you and you've got an income to cover the interest, because it's like a tunnel and there is light at the end of the tunnel. But if something goes wrong, you lose your income, the bank fails to support you. And remember, banks are wonderful people. They're the ones who'll lend you an umbrella when the sun is shining. The moment it starts to rain, they want it back. So if they call up those loans, people will be toast. They'll end up going into, as individuals, becoming bankrupt. And that's horrific. So we all need to understand that it's about trying to get a level of balance. And Peter, I think you've got it. Clearly, the amount of debt that you've got is not that significant compared to some of the main centres. You've probably got tremendous value for the $300,000 you spent on your house. You've done all these renovations. I'll tell you what, $80,000 worth of renovations. I don't know how much you had done, but I've seen in some houses that just covers the kitchen, let alone the rest of the house. So, again, seems that to me that you were making what I call sane, sound, sensible decisions on where to spend your money.
Yeah.
And, using KiwiSaver to get you into the home, again, you're using the system, very sensible. Now that you've done that and you're back into KiwiSaver, hopefully you're into a growth fund, not a conservative or balanced fund, because in this sort of market, in this volatile market, you'll really reap the benefits of having a growth strategy through I don't know who your KiwiSaver is from, but maybe it's with ASB if that's where you're banking. I don't know. But any of the major institutions, if you're in one of those growth funds where it's been sensibly managed, the money's been sensibly invested, you will reap the benefits as we come through this period of volatility and things go back on a steady but upward track.
Cool. Well, I hope you found that valuable, Peter, they were calling you now.
Yeah, well, I suppose, can I just add another thing?
What, insurance?
I don't give, I'm not, I've got the qualifications that a good insurance or life agent would have. I've got what they call a CLU, the Certified Life Underwriter, but I don't give advice in that area. I would refer it on to someone who works specifically in that area. But looking at your situation and thinking about risk management, I would be saying, well, everything at the moment is dependent on your income, and what happens if you can't work and you're on a sickness benefit, things could turn pear-shaped quite quickly. So I'd be recommending that you look at getting some advice in respect of income replacement, income insurance, so that if you were unable to work, not through accident, but through sickness, because through accident you'd get 80% of your salary under ACC, but through sickness you'd get nothing. You'd end up on a sickness benefit, which I don't know what that would give you, maybe $20,000 a year. It wouldn't be much more than that.
No,
and you'd be in trouble then. Maybe you'd have to stay in the home and look after the young child and your wife could go out to work, but she may not, or your partner could go out to work, but she might not be able to earn $120,000 a year or anything like that. That's why I don't know your specific situation, but I'd certainly look at the income replacement cover. It's not expensive for younger people. You can reduce the cost by having a longer wait period, something like 2 or 3 months before a claim is lodged. And again, that's another reason for having a little bit of money aside as an emergency fund.
Mm.
You know, certainly up to a month, but no more than 3 months of your expenditure. You can deal with that a little bit with credit cards as a short-term contingency. Credit cards are very good for that. You know, if you need money immediately, they're just not a great thing to use as a source of borrowing, because you're not going to be paying the sort of interest rate that you're getting there. They'll be 20%, not 5 or 4%. But you know, you've got to think about, if something went wrong and I was unable to work, how do we get through that period? And if it's sustained, income replacement cover is a great way of doing it. The other cover I'd be looking at, and you probably got it anyway, is, because I think the bank would request it, you need some sort of life cover. So that if you died, there's a sum of money that would reduce the debt and would be available to assist your partner to maintain the lifestyle for her and your child. So it wouldn't be enough to just cover the mortgage. You know, if you say, oh, I've got life cover that gives me $240,000, so my partner's debt-free, everything will be good. No, it won't be good, because you know, I don't know what her income earning ability is with a young child. Emotionally, she may not be able to go back to work anyway, but you're such a great man that she's just probably going to take some time to get over you. Or you not being there. So I'd be looking for you to have a level of cover of maybe $500,000, plus or minus, to ensure that if something happened to you, the debt would be gone, there'd be a pool of money to assist your partner to be able to maintain the lifestyle that she and your child needs. On the other side, and a big mistake, is people often insure the breadwinner for income replacement or for life, but forget about the other person. I'd be saying to you that your partner should have a level of cover, not necessarily as high as yours, but because if she died, you'd still be able to work, hopefully. But again, emotionally, you may struggle with that a little bit for a period of time. But I would suggest that she needs a level of cover around about the $300,000 plus or minus. That would get rid of the debt, would free up a little bit of money if you needed to get some support or take time off work to get through it. I've been through this, Peter. I lost my wife when I was 39. She was 40, and we had children that were at that stage 9 and 6. And the only way I really coped with it was just to keep working. I had to keep working. Because we didn't have an appropriate life cover at that time. So I'm talking from experience that it's a mistake not to insure your partner in these sort of situations. So there's the risk management stuff. You may or may not have medical insurance. That's a bit of personal insurance. Surely you've insured the house and the car and all those things. Everyone knows that. But sometimes people forget to insure their most important asset.
Yeah,
and that's you and your ability to earn an income.
Fair. All right. Well, Peter, we're calling you. I hope you got a lot of value out of that. And now, just as we wrap it up, I mean, Jordan Grever wasn't too involved in this episode, but in the coming episodes, I'm sure we'll interact and you'll hear more about his side of things, and it brings a bit more interest and colloquial entertainment to the financial draw that we like to bring out, because it adds value, but it's hard to continually stay engaged with this sort of topic.
Do you think Jordan's more entertaining than we are?
Oh,
he's better looking.
Oh yeah, he's got that. Yeah, just assume he's better looking. He's behind the camera. We'll just wrap this up, as it's probably one of the longer episodes we've done. And once again, if you have any questions, Ryan@oneplan.co.nz. Effectively just had 10 minutes dedicated to Peter. So yeah, please write in. We're happy to help, and it's all about improving the financial education of New Zealanders.